Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work, the 24th new one since the election of Donald Trump. And I'm going to be joined today by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author David K. Johnston to talk about his new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. After hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades, in 2014, I stopped recording new live interviews. And the shows continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives. Podcasts available anytime, anywhere, iTunes, Podomatic, my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same site. But with the election of Donald Trump, I could not resist exploring the path forward in new interviews. I've got Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Erwin Chemerinsky on the legal issues. They're all available at my website and at iTunes. And before I start with David, let me offer you a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to Trump and a movement toward the healthy and just future we need. And I would say focus on the elections in 2018. Indivisibleguide.com. That's one word, indivisibleguide.com. OurRevolution.com. Again, one word, Our Revolution. That's the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, which for years was primarily online activism, now tying its work much more closely to grassroots in the streets. FiveCalls.org, which tells you the most relevant and timely calls you might make at any time. TownHallProject.com, which tells you when your representatives or nearby representatives are going to be holding town halls near you. And Courage Campaign, one word, CourageCampaign.org. Like Move On, only for the state of California, a long time, very, very successful online activism site that now is also coordinating much more closely with folks on the ground. Okay, now to today's guest. When David K. Johnston was 19 years old, the San Jose Mercury hired him as a staff writer. His investigations over the next four decades appeared in that paper and the New York Times, the Detroit Free Press, the LA Times, Philadelphia Inquirer. He exposed LAPD political spying and brutality. He solved a vicious murder by confronting the real killer, winning freedom for an innocent man. He explained the economics of former GE chairman Jack Welch's retirement perks, prompting Welch to relinquish them. And he's probably covered Donald Trump as much or more than any journalist. In late 2016, Johnston founded DC Report, dcreport.org, an online journal covering the president's administration and Congress. And his books include Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. The Making of Donald Trump and his latest, It's Even Worse Than You Think. Welcome once again, David K. Johnston.
Well, Terrence, thank you for having me again. Good to be back in L.A.
Yeah. And first, let me let listeners know we're recording this interview January 30th, a few hours before Trump's first State of the Union address. And as you know, David, I like listeners to get a feel for the people, not just the work and the ideas. So you're a pretty rare example of an independent investigative journalist. How did that happen, and how does it work?
Well, all the years I was on the payroll as a staff writer for newspapers, my attitude was not that I'm an employee, but I'm a small businessman, and I'm in the job of selling articles that I want to write that I think are important. And I had plenty of ideas. So if an editor said, I don't want this, I'd say, well, all right, well, let's do this. And I will tell you, one night when I was briefly assigned by the LA Times to cover the Music Center and was told, cover it the way you would do it. I mean, it's a sacred cow, right? This is Mrs. Chandler's specialty. They said, my editor said, I don't know how long it's going to last, but as long as it does, do your thing. And there was an event to be held outdoors, and it rained suddenly, which is kind of unusual in L.A. We usually know when the rain's coming. Right. So everybody in their tuxedos and fancy dresses picks up the tables, takes them inside, and I end up sitting with Bill Kieschnick, the head of ARCO. And he says, so how do they pay you people? Something about string. And, of course, if you're an outsider, you got paid based so much an inch for your copy in the past. And I said, no, I'm on salary. He said, but how do they know if you're working? And I said, you know, you could write a lot of stuff and it's worthless. Editors know what you're doing. I said, you know what your engineers are doing at ARCO. And then I said, but by the way, I never think of myself as an employee. I think of myself as a little entrepreneur. And he turns to one of his guys and goes, we don't have people thinking like that at ARCO, do we?
Fabulous.
And I go, Bill, you want people thinking like that because they're the ones that are going to make your enterprise do better. You don't want drones.
Right.
So anyway, it's just always been my attitude. And you pay a price for it. I mean, you know, I worked for 5 big papers. I didn't spend my whole career at the LA Times, right, or the New York Times. And in addition, you know, the people I ticked off, Daryl Gates, United Way here in LA, Lockheed, you know, eventually so many people complain about you that when an editor sees you coming, their attitude is, oh boy, there goes next week, dealing with lawyers and other people. And, you know, understandably, you know, editors eventually get tired of that, so you go somewhere else.
And so you've been independent now for how many years?
I left the New York Times. It'll be 10 years in April.
Okay. So the first few times I interviewed you, you were still at the Times, yeah, doing tax and finance and so on. And obviously, more time to write books now that you're...
Yes. You know, I did The Making of Donald Trump last year, which is in 11 languages around the world. The current book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, is number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list the first week it's eligible. I'm trying to finish, even as I'm traveling, and I've got trips set up all over the country and in Europe on this book, my next book, which is a proposed entirely new federal tax system for the 21st century economy, which would be the 4th time America has, would have, if I get it enacted, changed its tax policy. Taxes have to flow from the existing economic order, and America has a tax system that was designed more than 100 years ago and was terrific. It's absolutely a terrific system for the economy of 1950.
Which is when things went very well.
Yes.
And 50 to 73.
Right. We don't live in that anymore,
right,
and we need to have a new tax system. And I spent years, when I first talked to various other people about my idea, they just poked holes in it like crazy. The last person I sat down with, who's a tax lawyer, an accountant, and a full business professor, spent 4 hours with me and couldn't poke a hole in the system. And at the end said, you know, I sort of knew who you were but hadn't read your work, and I figured, oh, well, this will be a waste of my time. And looked at me and said, you've actually done it. And I said, really? And she said, yeah. There were five little minor problems, one of which was just a misstatement of fact by me. And I took care of them. They were very minute little details. So, yeah, I hope to have that out a year from now. Depends on how much time I spent trying to get people to understand who Donald really is.
Right, no, it's interesting.
Even people who don't like Donald, generally, when I talk to them, they don't really know who he is.
Right, right. I mean, I'm thinking that book, had you not had Trump in the White House, which meant you had to
be— It would
be
out by now.
That's what I'm saying, and it would have been out when they were debating the tax bill.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what you were looking forward to. Okay. We've said you're one of the folks who's covered Trump the longest, the most, and so on. How did you first encounter him, and how closely have you followed him over the years?
Well, I met Donald right after I left the LA Times. I went to the Philadelphia Inquirer at the end of May 1988 to cover Atlantic City. And my idea was the Supreme Court had issued a decision that I believed would lead to casinos all across America. It basically said Indians had the right to have casinos, and what's the history of America? Anything the red man has, the white man takes away. And editors of the LA Times, when I proposed this idea to them, thought, you know, said, well, you don't know what's going to happen in the future. How can you say that? And I'd say, because there's historical precedent for it, you know? You know, think. And so anyway, Philadelphia Inquirer sent me to Atlantic City, and I met Donald right off. And my first impression of him was, oh, that's P.T. Barnum. You know, hey, come see the Fiji mermaid and the bearded woman. Except, of course, P.T. Barnum never hurt anybody, and everybody except little children or fools knew that these were hoaxes. So Donald Trump owned 2 casinos at the time, and there were only 7 or 8 at that time, and was clearly the most important person in Atlantic City. So I started preparing to have my first detailed interview with him. And I talked to the owner of one of the competing casinos, and almost the first thing he said to me was, Donald doesn't know anything about running a casino. He doesn't know a damn thing about the business. And I looked at him. I said, come on, the man owns 2 casinos. How can he not know the business? And he said, he doesn't know anything. And so then I talked to some government regulators, and they had a polite phrase. They would say, Donald is not an operator.
He plays a different role.
Yes. You know, he was to bring attention and whatnot. So then I got to talking to Donald's own guys. And so it doesn't surprise to me this White House leaks like a sieve.
Yes.
And his own guys said, yeah, Donald doesn't know anything. And with their connivance, I put together 4 questions. The first one was about craps. And I don't remember the question. And unfortunately, I have a cat who decided that I was dying to make use of my notebook, a box full of my notebooks, so I don't have those anymore. But it was a question about craps.
That anyone who knew the
business would immediately know the answer to. And Donald took the falsehood I put into my question and repeated it to me. And I remember exactly what I thought at the time. Hi, is your boyfriend loyal to you? Is your husband going to leave you? We're California psychics. We're the real psychics. We know. He's a con artist. He just makes it up.
Yeah.
And people don't critically question him. And he had gone repeatedly to the New York Post, somewhat to the Daily News, but mostly the New York Post, to reporters who are never going to let facts get in the way of a good story. And he would plant these stories that were ridiculous. You know, I'm the biggest real estate developer in New York. He's not even number five.
Yeah.
I'm the richest man in New York. You're not even number 50, and probably not number 2,860. And you know, the New York, famous New York Post headline, best sex ever, which Marla Maples years later appeared on the show Designing Women. And at the end of it, she turns and looks at the camera and says, I never said that. So anyway, I realized immediately that he was just full of malarkey. And then I began learning that there were issues in his casinos about women and blacks and Asians and bad business decisions that suggested that he was not going to do well, and there were regulatory issues. And I had gone there to see, in part, had New Jersey done what it promised, gotten the mob out, cleaned up the business, and made this historically corrupt business reasonably honest. And by the way, the only case ever shown of a casino cheating customers in Atlantic City was at a Trump casino, Trump Castle.
Wow.
So anyhow, early on when I met him, he bought through a lease arrangement the ship he renamed the Trump Princess. He only went on it once from New York to Atlantic City. And when he got off, he looked green. I mean, we know later that, in fact, he was seasick and hated it and said, I'm never getting on this thing again.
And was afraid he'd see a shark.
Or whatever. And but as he's walking to the Trump's Castle Casino from where the boat is docked, there are these young women jumping up and down going, Donald, 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 as if it was Bruce Springsteen or if they were their mother's Elvis Presley or the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is very strange. And then he gets on the escalator to go up into the castle, and a guy shouts out, hey, Donald, be our president.
And this is back?
This is in 88 or 89.
Wow.
And at that point, it sort of cemented in my mind, this guy is an important cultural force in the country beyond this industry. You need to seriously pay attention to him. So just as I collected files on Baron Hilton his whole life, you know, who ripped off his father's charity for his own benefit, although in the end the charity made more money perhaps because of it. And I stuck with Daryl Gates till he died,
right.
And Jack Welch and a few other people. I just said, you got to stay watching this guy. Now, I didn't write much about him once I joined the New York Times in 1995 because, as he had done in Philadelphia, Trump comes with a bunch of lawyers to the paper demanding that I be gotten rid of or not write about him. So I was there to do taxes, so I just fed what I knew to other reporters.
Yeah. Yeah.
With varying degrees of success. But I kept track of him. I kept building up my file of documents. And in 2012, when Trump announced he was running for president, every political reporter, I think they should be called, by the way, politics reporters.
Yes, yes.
They all treated him seriously, you know, every one of them. He's running for president. And exactly two people in this business, Lawrence O'Donnell and me, said, no, he's not. He's running for a new contract with NBC. He will announce his president. His campaign is over the minute he gets a better contract. And then he did. And the politics reporters, of course, felt foolish. They had egg on their face. They looked like idiots. So when he announced in 2015, he comes down the escalator with Melania. I immediately said, he's serious this time. And I said, I was on a radio show a couple days later. I said, I think the politics reporters are going to think this is a joke because they got their clocks cleaned.
Right, right.
And I started writing pieces saying, here are 21 questions to ask Donald Trump.
I remember
Look
that.
Look into this about Donald Trump. You should be reporting about that. I called former editors of mine at the New York Times, friends at the Washington Post and the AP and the LA Times. And I said, you know, he's serious and you need to pay attention because he may well get the nomination. And while I don't think he can get elected, he might. And you can't exclude the possibility. And I got, frankly, I failed. I mean, Donald has said publicly, I failed. It's in the back of my
book. It's a blurb.
And he's right. I failed. I could not get my peers in journalism. And the reason for that seems to be very clear. Instead of doing what we call a scrub. So if you go into the archives of the New York Times, you know, you can find out who were the boys that Barack Obama played with in kindergarten in Indonesia, who were the boys he smoked dope with in Hawaii in high school, and who were some of the women he dated in college. You can go back and read about George W. Bush's failed period in his life of being a oil and gas tax shelter salesman, a business that requires acute knowledge of highly detailed information. So, of course, he wasn't successful at it. You can do that for every candidate. Trump was never scrubbed. And so, you know, here's Donald Trump, who was deeply involved with a major cocaine trafficker and where very unusual things that I tell about in both books happen. Nobody wrote about it. When I was interviewed on PBS, they cut all that stuff out. Donald, his grandfather was a draft dodger from Germany who made a fortune running whorehouses in Seattle and Everett and in the Yukon Territory. And his father was a massive cheat on the taxpayers. And almost none of this stuff got printed anywhere because you know how we all rubberneck, especially here in Southern California?
Yes.
Well, Donald Trump was the accident across the way with dancing girls, a marching band, and fireworks. And people forgot to say, but who is he?
Well, I think, and I'm sure you've said this, but they did not take him seriously. He was a boon to the media.
Yep.
And it would make them money, and it would be both print and television, and then he would finish out of the nomination, and we'd all go on, and he'd go back to TV.
Exactly. And there's a second element to this, which is that none of the major news organizations have ever been comfortable dealing with the interface between those business people who associate with the mob. And I don't mean just the Italian mob. I mean Russian mobsters, swindlers, all sorts of criminals, and the straight business world. You know, most businesses are not in bed with major criminals. But major news organizations generally would report about this because there's an indictment or the government has taken some action. They don't like doing it on their own. And, you know, there are litigation issues about it if you do that. I mean, I acknowledge that's a problem. But in Donald's case, there's such a robust public record. And then the second problem you have is, you know, what's the fastest disappearing white-collar job in America in this century? Journalist. Yeah. 40% of the jobs are gone. There's no money. When the LA Times hired me as a national correspondent, I flew first class everywhere.
Oh, my God.
Now, you know, I've literally talked to LA Times reporters who had people question why they took a cab instead of a bus.
Yeah, yeah. You mean people, their superiors. Yeah.
People that are now and their bosses. Yeah, yeah. Or now recently were there.
Yeah, yeah. So, and one thing, before we move to the current book, one thing I would imagine is behind your upset is that if the day after the escalator they came out with the worst stuff, at that point it might have made a difference. Once the momentum got going and the circus was coming to town, that stuff couldn't get through. And I'm not saying they didn't do it.
But they didn't. But actually, they generally didn't do it.
Right. But we found out some stuff that would have disqualified anyone else. But by then, the game had changed.
Well, and there's a second element to this, which is to be personally, you know, ironic. My book's Perfectly Legal on Taxes, Free Lunch on Subsidies to Wealthy People, and the Fine Print on Monopolies. Donald's economic platform, not his racist platform, but his economic platform comes out of those books.
Yeah.
I know Donald watched, he doesn't read books, but I know he watched me on television because he told other people things. And he distilled my message, which is, you know, those books show all these laws that almost nobody knew about that I dug out of the public record about ways in which the federal government and state governments reach into your pocket and they take a penny or a dime or a nickel every day and redistribute it to very wealthy people like Warren Buffett and GE and Donald Trump. And those they're still all in print. You know, the first one won an award as the Investigative Book of the Year. And Donald took this economic message that I had said in 2012, if somebody runs for president on these three books, they will get elected because the bottom 90% of Americans have real grievances. In fact, in 2012, 90% of Americans had a lower income than they had in 1967, the year I graduated from high school.
Yeah, and I'm going to occasionally I repeat something someone says. 90% of Americans had a lower annual income.
Adjusted for inflation, obviously.
Right, of course. In 2012 than in 67.
That's right.
That's, I mean.
They basically got 51 and a half weeks pay for 52 weeks.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, they had all this uncertainty. You suddenly had two income families to make it. Because you didn't have unions, people got fired at both union and non-union companies much more easily. Pensions had been eliminated or eroded. We took pensions, which were a supplement on top of your salary, and a benefit you earned, because you could have taken it as cash wages, and replaced them with a 401k, which is you save out of your salary. And companies made the switch because they were able to trick everybody into thinking this was a benefit when, in fact, it was a cut. It was a pay cut.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, I mean, you haven't even mentioned the changing, the changes of technology, the changes of globalization, all those things that have happened since. I usually cite 73, which is the last time real wages rose.
Right. But it was also the year when the largest percentage of American workers belonged to a union. And when 37% of private sector workers belonged to a union, 80% of workers benefited. I was dragooned into becoming chairman of the Newspaper Guild at the Philadelphia Inquirer in 93 to lead negotiations for a new contract because they found out they'd left a bunch of money on the table the time before. If there's one thing I know how to do, it's how to count. And I was floored when these low-level management people would come to me, you know, low-level editors, people in advertising, and they'd say, so how are the union talks going? And I'd say, why do you care? You're not in the union. They'd say, ah, come on, my pay is set by the union. I'm just not in the union, but what you get is what I'm going to get. And that's exactly right. So when you decimate the unions, and some employers, the LA Times was the best paying newspaper in America because they, and not just in the newsroom, they had the best paid telephone operators, janitors, because they wanted to keep unions out, not because of the pay, but the work rules. That's what employers don't want are the work rules. And so so unions encourage this premium pay. Now the LA Times, overwhelmingly the news staff has voted to unionize.
Yeah, last week.
And, you know, it goes to what saying I have my union friends hate, but it's, you know, if you're a company with a union, you deserve one.
Okay, let's move to the new book. It's Even Worse Than You Think, what the Trump administration is doing to America. And tell me, how you came to write it, but how does it relate to DC Report? In other words, to me, they seem, you know, one's the online version, one's the hardback.
There's some connection between them. And I try to be very careful that if I use anything in the book, I will put money into DC Report because I don't want anybody, I don't get paid. It's a volunteer operation. And I don't want anybody to think I'm using the charity for my benefit.
Because you will make money from the book, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feed myself and hire people to work with me.
And how you
pay
feed DC Report.
Yeah. And so when Trump won the Electoral College, an institution that was created by the framers, so in case some crazy person or zealot was chosen by the mob, there would be a check and balance, and that person would be denied the presidency. And, of course, after 200 years of not needing it, it atrophied. Well, we needed it when Andrew Jackson came along, but I immediately said, okay, we've got to do something because my fellow journalists had done such a terrible job in the campaign. Now, they have done a vastly better job than I expected of covering the palace intrigues and the tweets in the White House. Really good job. I'm incredibly impressed by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Politico.
Yeah.
They've done a great job.
But you make a specific thing. They've done a great job of the intrigues.
That's right.
They've done
the palace intrigues and the tweets.
The politics,
right.
Not the actual actions.
Right. So what I immediately said was, well, I know it will not happen in any event. They're not going to cover the government. You know, when I got hired in the New York Times, I wrote in one of my books, you know, to cover taxes. All sorts of people knew me and went, oh, my God, this is like the end of your career. Who going to cover the IRS? And I said, no, you don't understand. It's never been covered right. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me at that point. And so I said, well, DC Report, which my friend Adam Leipzig, who's was for many years an executive in the movie business here and whatnot, and runs Cultural Weekly, and David Crook, who's a former editor at the Wall Street Journal, and I decided we would do this project, which is, you know, we haven't gotten big foundation grants or anything else. We depend on all the people who send us $5 or $10 a month and pay our writers virtually nothing. And I don't take any money out of it. And we said, we're going to cover what Trump does, not what he tweets. We're going to cover what Congress does, not what they say. And so we read the the Federal Register, which is the official government announcements of what the government is doing. We read the congressional record. We look around for actions. Some of the stories we've done have led to coverage by others, which we do and don't get credit for from time to time. We've gotten the government, we think, to change some policies. We can certainly show that they did something. We reported on it. They changed. And a lot of journalists read D.C. Report, and so do some political ops operatives.
Let me just jump in for one second. Yeah. Didn't something along that line just happen with the Pebble Mine?
Well, we were in the forefront of
Tell people what it is.
Well, the Pebble Mine is a proposal to mine in Alaska, which will have a devastating effect, according to all the scientists who've studied this and the industry, the fishing industries, on salmon fishing and other environmental effects. And it's not like we're in desperate need of the minerals that are in the Pebble Mine. And so we wrote a lot about it, and the government initially put a stop to it. And, you know, because I've been traveling writing the book, I know there's a new development, but I don't know what it is.
Oh, okay. The last report I read was good news.
Oh, that's right. That they said we're not going to allow them to proceed. We'll see how long that lasts.
It was like the only good news I saw come out of the EPA
in a long time.
Since this administration.
Well, we reported on how they used to put up reports when workers are killed on the job. About 4,800 Americans a year are killed on the job.
And it's interesting. What you're saying is the federal government used to report on every occupational death, which I didn't even realize.
And they would put out under Obama and a guy named Jordan Barab who worked there at Labor, they began trying to shame companies. Because the cost of a dead worker can be far less than the cost of proper safety.
Sure.
Now, you know, most companies really try to do the right thing. But there are terrible, terrible employers out there who just don't care.
Right. One of whom's running for Senate right now, right? I'm thinking of the coal miner.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. And Donald.
But I don't mean coal miner. He owns a coal mining company.
He owns a coal mining company. Right, right.
Yeah.
And you know, Donald was somebody who never cared about these sorts of things. So we ran a piece about they're not putting up these press releases to shame the companies. Then they started putting them back up. Then they stopped. Now, I can't tell you we caused them to do it. I can just tell you the timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
They stopped posting just the listings of deaths, you know, on this date, in this city, this person, this age.
So this was the Labor Department.
The Labor Department.
And they someone who not, died in the course of work. Yeah.
And they have not posted a worker death since last August. And now they are refusing to provide the basic statistical information, you know.
So you're not just saying they don't post it every day. You can't find out what's
right.
happened in
so
3 months.
So you want to know how many people died in construction, how many people died in steelmaking, how many people died in, you know, how many. They won't give you this data now, and this is part of what's going on. The Trump administration is determined to end democracy as we know it. And people who think they know that, and they come to talks that I give and they go, oh, I know everything's in your book. And I go, no, you do not.
That's right.
You cannot, because it hasn't been out there. Some of it has, or it's been glancingly there. What you know is the awful things Trump has done speaking. And what I'm trying to do is get people to understand, saying, it is our government. I hate that newspapers call it
the government
or the Constitution. At D.C. Report, we say our government because, as my friend David Crook says, we own it and we need to act like owners. And we're not. We're acting like absentee owners, too many of us. And so from D.C. Report, I immediately said, you know, good a job as the press may or may not do. I don't know what's going to happen. They're never going to cover what's happening to our government. They're never going to cover the agencies. There's no reporters anymore at these agencies. And it was considered sort of a not good career move to cover one of them, but there's nobody there now. And I said, I can do this. Even though it's me, I get some researchers and help and spend some money and we can find. And then what I do, as you know, Terrence, is I don't write policy books like professors write that, you know, you.
Yeah.
I've spent more of my life reading policy books than I care to think of. I wish I could get all those years back. What I do is I find people to illustrate the story and make them come to life, because that's how we learn. We learn by stories, and I embed the policy in. When I did my first book on the casino industry, which was pretty much policy, I remember saying to my agent, you know, we don't need to worry about the dramatic rights. There's no movie rights in this book. Well, I got paid for 17 years for the movie rights to that book, even though the movie never got made.
Yeah, that's Hollywood.
And what did somebody very brilliant in Hollywood, one of the top actors in Hollywood who bought it, do? You hired a writer who just threw away my public policy and took my characters. And when my wife read the screenplay, she said, you know, there's only two things wrong with this. And I said, what's that? She said, the ending is messy. I can fix that. It's easy. And I said, what's the other problem? She says, I haven't seen the movie yet.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. And, I mean, this is basically Michael Lewis's approach.
Yeah. I will confess, he's better at this than I am. He's more elegant
I mean, Malcolm Gladwell and Ira Glass both say favorite storyteller. But that same thing. You find the stories
to illustrate the policy.
Yeah. I mean, even if the policy stuff is as crazy as The Big Short.
That's right.
I just, before we leave the DC report, I want to say again, it's DC Report.
Singular.
Singular. Because it's so easy to think it's DC Reports. DCReport.org. And not only will you, on a pretty much a daily basis, find out news, but you will also be guided toward action, yes?
Right. We run things called action boxes. So in some cases, we just like give Scott Pruitt's main phone number. Or we tell you which members of Congress to call or send a letter to. We don't tell you what to say. I mean, I'm certain there are people who read this and they call Scott Pruitt's office and say, we're right with you, man.
Yeah.
That's fine. What we want is people to be involved in our government.
It's their government, too.
That's right.
People that agree with Scott
I want a better government because of better ideas. I don't want one because of more political money.
Right. Right. Yeah, which is, of course, what's happened. One of the things you start off the book with is this particular scene of the Trump motorcade in D.C. on Inauguration Day. But to you, that indicates a problem that is not a policy problem, but it's a deeper problem.
Oh, it's a problem about Donald Trump being a criminal and completely corrupt and knowing nothing. So Donald Trump delivers this god-awful inauguration address. And then he gets in the Beast, as the presidential car is called, with his wife and the youngest son. And they're going along. And one of the things you notice if you go look at it on YouTube is when Barack Obama came, there were enormous crowds, 6, 8, 10 people deep on the sidewalks cheering. In Donald's case, there's very few people around, and half of the folks are opposed to him. And the motorcade suddenly stops. And the pool camera in the truck in front of the president's limousine never varies. It just takes a look at, you know, Donald gets out, Melania in that incredibly elegant ice blue dress gets out, and the rest of the family gets out, and they take a 2-minute turn in the middle of the street. Well, where did they stop? None of the television networks told you. No radio reporters didn't tell you. They stopped in front of the old post office and clock tower, rebranded as the Trump Washington International Hotel. And the message that Donald Trump was sending is, you want something for my administration, you will pay tribute. You will come and buy my $60 and up steaks. You will buy my $36 and up cocktails. You will rent rooms and function rooms. And the Al-Sabah family were the first where this was clear. The Al-Sabah family owns so much oil-rich real estate in the Middle East that they call their family business a country, Kuwait.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And they hold a party every year to celebrate their independence, but also to thank America for freeing them from Saddam Hussein and, you know, for American soldiers making sure that they personally reinstalled the gold faucets in the emir's personal bathroom. They held this party at the Four Seasons, which is probably the fanciest hotel in Washington. Now, as soon as Trump took office, they moved it to Trump's place.
Yeah.
And there's pretty good evidence that this was not by accident at all. That bar
in the Trump hotel
is so full of foreign governments and corporate lobbyists seeking favors that Trump had filed documents, or his company, his organization had, that projected they would lose money the first year. His bar has taken in $68,000 a night.
Wow.
If you know anybody who owns a bar, ask somebody, well, how'd you be doing if you took in $68,000 a night? That's just an eye-popping figure. And given the price for the drinks, it's not a huge volume of business.
Right.
Dave and Buster's.
Now, let me just ask a quick question, because even when I read it, and I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea, if you say that the camera pool for the networks didn't see the hotel, who did? So how does he send the signal?
Well, what I did is I simply went to Google Earth.
But I'm saying, if he's sending a signal, it has to be visible, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, in this case, the sophisticated people knew. When I saw it, I knew where they were. I was sure where they were stopping.
I see.
And I just went to Google Earth to make sure.
Got it.
And I put in the address of the hotel and did a little 360, and you could see the buildings in the background. And
By the way, did you see what he's doing? Speaking of using a stream, I was thinking maybe there was an online video, a streaming video. Do you know what he's doing with the State of the Union tonight?
No.
That there is a stream that's part of the Trump campaign that will stream the State of the Union. And if you give $35 or more, your name will be in a crawl under the State of the Union message, which is, of course, State of the Union message is a
so Trump,
is the whole country. Yeah. Boom.
Trump is doing two things here. In this matter, he is creating a kleptocracy, and I think we titled the chapter Kleptocracy Rising. And in that sense, he's no different than Vladimir Putin, you know, who heads a criminal gang of people who have the stolen wealth of the Russian peoples. The second thing Trump is doing is creating what the ancient Greeks call a kakistocracy. I used to teach the law of the ancient world to law students, although I'm not a lawyer, and to graduate business students. And a kakistocracy is a government of the worst people, the least qualified, the most venal, the most corrupt, the monsters. And look at who Trump has put in there.
Yeah.
You know, Betsy DeVos, who knows nothing of education, Ben Carson for Housing and Urban Development, apparently at one time brilliant child brain surgeon who believes that the pyramids are granaries, Scott Pruitt, who's vowed to destroy the EPA.
And as Attorney General of Oklahoma, had sued the EPA 14 times.
And is trying to become the senator from Carbon Fuel Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And all the way through the government, he's just appointed awful people. And then there are what I call the political termites.
Right.
These are the people you don't see.
Let me do one thing before you get into the termites, which is remind people this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, whose latest book is It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. And you can learn more at davidkjohnston.com. That's davidcayjohnston.com and dcreport.org. Okay, the termites. So you're saying, and by the way, I just want to say, is Scott Pruitt a termite or is he?
He's the queen termite.
Okay,
it's the people underneath him don't see.
Right.
So normally you appoint people to various federal positions and well below the cabinet secretary level, many of them have to be approved by the Senate. And even if they aren't formally approved, their names are run by the leaders in Congress. Well, Trump has put in all sorts of people under a rule that allows you to appoint an executive for 130 days on a temporary basis. And you should have one. What if suddenly the deputy assistant secretary for Russian affairs drops dead? You need to be able to put somebody in. 130 days is enough time to vet somebody and get a new person. Some of these people are still there. And we're now in season two of Donald Trump, the White House reality show. They've been there for more than a year, some of them.
So although it's normally 130,
legally 130. They're supposed to be gone after 130 days, and no one is enforcing the law here. And who are these people? Well, Betsy DeVos is confronted with this huge student loan problem that her testimony showed at her hearing she doesn't understand at all. And so she says, we're going to solve
this. She didn't need a loan.
Yeah. nice thing for Betsy DeVos, when she travels on official business, she flies in her own jet and does not bill the government for
right.
it. But who does she turn to resolve the problems of student loan debt? She brings in lobbyists from the student loan companies.
Yep, yep.
This is not the fox guarding the hen house. This is the fox in a position to redesign the hen house to maximize the eating of the foxes by the foxes. In the EPA, they bring in a whole bunch of people from the fossil fuel companies. And I tell the story of one longtime high-level EPA manager who says all year she was there, whoever was the EPA administrator or acting administrator, clear back to Christy Whitman, the former Republican governor of Jersey, they would come to her office and say, can we talk for a minute? Or they'd say, will you come to my office? And they would discuss the problems of running the agency and conflicts and demands by business. Everything changed when Trump became president. Scott Pruitt had the doors locked to where he is. His staff won't tell anybody where they are. If you call, they don't return your calls. They issued an order to her group that you are to prepare detailed reports in writing of every weakness in the cases you might bring to enforce the environmental laws. Every single thing, and being good bureaucrats, they complied with what they're told. Then they're told to come to a meeting, and Scott Pruitt happens to be in the meeting that I described personally. And they say, now you brief us and tell us all of this stuff. The only questions they asked were either little technical things or, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that word. They gave no feedback or anything else because they were not interested in better policy. And then they took the reports and said, thank you very much. What do they do with that? Well, we don't literally know because they're not responding to Freedom of Information Act requests, but let's be adults. They went and gave it to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and to ExxonMobil and to the coal companies and all the other polluters who now have a roadmap to how not to have the law enforced against them. This is disloyal to the United States. And I don't want to beat around the bush about it. Donald Trump is not loyal. And whoever is president, I don't care what your politics are, the president of the United States is supposed to be loyal to our country. Richard Nixon committed numerous crimes. His tax lawyer here in L.A. went to prison for him. But nobody, nobody ever suggested for one second that Richard Nixon was disloyal.
Right.
He's a crook. He's paranoid. He's a son of a bitch. But nobody ever thought for a moment he was disloyal. Donald Trump is not a loyal American.
That's right. He's not loyal to anything but Donald Trump.
Donald Trump. Man, is he loyal to Donald Trump.
And so we're not even saying he's more loyal to Putin than he is to the U.S. He's not loyal to anybody but himself, but that's disloyal.
Right. And in the case of the EPA, Donald doesn't care about these things and he doesn't know about them. One of the points I made in the previous book and document is, from his own written words and testimonies, Donald Trump is an ignoramus. He doesn't know anything. During the campaign, Hugh Hewitt, the smart right-wing radio host who lives down in Orange County, had him got to ask him a question in the Fox News debate in December of 2015. So, Mr. Trump, if we had to cut our defense budget, what are your priorities for the nuclear triad?
Oh, right.
And Trump goes, oh, nuclear, it's so big. You know, I know everything about nuclear because my Uncle John at MIT, a really smart school, really smart guy, he taught me everything about nuclear. It's like it's so massive, which tells you, of course, he doesn't know a damn thing.
No.
And he asked the question a second time, and Trump says the same, you know, word salad garbage.
Right.
Hewitt then turns to Marco Rubio and says, well, Senator Rubio, same question to you. Now, Marco Rubio is a pretty empty suit.
He is.
But what did he come back and say? Well, for those who are not aware, the nuclear triad is the capacity of the military of the United States of America to deliver nuclear weapons from land-based missiles, sea-based missiles, and jet bombers. Well, it turns out Hugh Hewitt had asked this question on his radio show 4 months earlier, the exact same question. And I happened to run into Hugh Hewitt, the only time I ever met him, coming out of a TV studio where he had spoken and I was going to go in to speak. And we talked about this. And he said, isn't that amazing? 4 months to prepare and he didn't even try to learn because Donald doesn't learn.
Now, let me ask you one thing that I wondered about, which was I thought that one of the predominant things was exactly what you said. Ignoramus, doesn't care, he doesn't know, all of that. I was surprised that he sought out people so anti each department. That surprised me. It seemed almost too conscientious on his part.
Well, what happened there, I
thought it would just be useless people, not enemies.
Yeah, I don't think he sought them out nearly so much because Donald's lazy. I mean, we now know, and the White House doesn't deny, that he spends 5 hours a day being president when it includes lunch.
And almost that same amount of time watching TV.
Oh, if not more.
Yeah.
If not more, And so what happened is the people he brought in. So he brings in Stephen Miller, who apparently his Santa Monica High School graduation talk had to be shut down because it was so awful. He brings in Steve Bannon, who says, I'm a Leninist, which means I want to destroy the existing order. And then Bannon goes on later in numerous interviews to make it clear, he would not use the word hate, but I would say the reasonable interpretation of what he wants is he hates the government of the United States and he wants to destroy it as we know it.
That's right, the regulatory state, the
administrative state, which is what the government is. That's what it does. So they brought in all these other people. Now, Trump brought in Michael Flynn, even though Barack Obama said, stay away from this guy. And we now know that Michael Flynn is a disloyal American who will eventually go to prison.
Right.
We have a 3-star general who acted against the interests of the United States, which is a very disturbing development. And Donald Trump only got rid of him when it became clear he was a liability to him. And that's what that's how Donald operates.
Right.
So it isn't so much that Donald did it. It's that he brought people who had these political termites in their back pocket and they just deposited them into the government.
Because I got to say, I thought it would just be incompetence, but not.
Well, there's plenty of that too.
But not people who you would pick who were absolutely the enemy of the department they were there to run. Okay. So I have a feeling that people know Pruitt's done bad stuff,
right.
Whether it's removing all references to climate change, not allowing people to speak, et cetera, et cetera. What are some of the things people don't know that a couple of instances of actions by secretaries that if you knew,
right.
You'd be flabbergasted?
Well, one of the most important is that until very recently, a large majority of countries had no ambassadors. Trump fired all the ambassadors just as he fired all the U.S. attorneys, and they haven't replaced people.
And Tillerson is complicit.
Well, he's complicit. And why is that? Well, you know, ExxonMobil's in a nasty business. It is also, paradoxically, probably the best managed company in the world if you're an investor. It's a very well-managed company. But Tillerson has at ExxonMobil had his own private military and his own private diplomatic corps, and he's trying to do deals that benefit ExxonMobil, and U.S. diplomats are out there saying, you know, you can't do this or this problem or that. So, of course, he's antagonistic to them. But Donald's always talking about his fear of Muslims and terrorists, right? Well, we don't have an ambassador in Libya or Egypt or Jordan or Saudi Arabia. So that's an example that's nonsense. A second one in this area is Trump makes his first foreign trip, and he goes to Riyadh. And what does he do? He praises the government in Saudi Arabia for leading the fight against terrorism. Who are the biggest funders of terrorism in the world? The Saudis. 59 of the 61 Muslim or connected groups or Middle East groups that the State Department says are terrorist organizations are funded by the Saudis one way or another.
And 9/11, right?
And 9/11, 19
of them.
People from Saudi Arabia. And at the same time, he attacks Qatar, the country that brought us Al Jazeera, where I used to be a columnist, that has opened up non-state-controlled news to people in the Middle East, which is one of the reasons we had the Arab Spring, one of the big reasons we had it, and which provides America with its most important military base. When Wilbur Ross, Trump's commerce secretary, who was a vulture capitalist, he would take bankrupt companies, get rid of the money they owed, ruin the pensions for the workers, borrow new money, pay himself a huge fee, and then put the zombie out until it stumbled and died. He comes back from this trip, and he goes on CNBC, and he says, you know, after he's being questioned, he volunteers. He says, you know, I got to tell you something. The people in Saudi Arabia, they all love us. It was astonishing. There wasn't a single protester anywhere, not one sign. And Becky Quick, the host, says, excuse me, but Mr. Secretary, it's a crime to protest in Saudi Arabia. They'll lash you with a bullwhip. And he goes, well, maybe, I don't know. But furthermore, let me tell you this. When I was ready to leave, my Saudi guards who had been with me all week, they come to my plane and they bring me these two bushel baskets of the most beautiful dates you've ever seen. What a heartfelt gift from these men. He is so totally clueless. He doesn't know this is from the government. It's not from these guys. They're just carrying out the orders of the dictator we call the king or prince in Saudi Arabia. I mean, these are
And
really...
right after his visit is when, under Saudi leadership, all the other countries of the Middle East turn on Qatar.
That's right. And Qatar is suddenly, you know, put in this terrible economic strain. It is just indicative of these people don't know what they're doing. They're causing damage. But here's one that should really worry your pocketbook. Donald killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think on your show I criticized it because it gave power to monopolies and was contrary to the interests of ordinary people. It needed to be fixed. Donald kills it. He does nothing to replace it. It's 12 countries in the Pacific, us but not China, and it's partly designed to contain China's political and military ambitions. And
that if China's
ambitions.
Not part of that, then China's on its own.
That's right.
This
and
way,
we have
China's
more
on
influence.
Its own, and we're on our own.
Right. So China then starts putting forth the RCEP. And when I speak to audiences, I say, raise your hand if you've
heard of the RCEP.
I've had like five people out of audiences totaling 5,000 or 6,000 now who've heard of it. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. It's 15 Pacific Rim countries led by China plus India. And Chinese emissaries are out there saying, listen, look at America's in decline. Look who's in their White House. You want a prosperous future? You have to pivot away from Washington and towards us. And Australia, our lapdog ally, whatever America says, Australians go, yes, we're for that. They are. I was in Australia in the fall to speak for a week, and the Australians are tilting slowly, but they're tilting slowly away from us and toward China. China, this is the best thing that's ever happened. No wonder President Xi is happy when he sees Trump. He plays him for the fool that he is.
Absolutely.
And in the long run, this is very bad for America's prestige. It's bad for democracy. Let's not forget, China is a dictatorship run by nine thugs called the Politburo. And after the first time I said that on national TV, and I think it was on CNN, my annual invitations to China, I've never gotten one since. So I assume those are connected, although I can't prove it. But China's a dictatorship. It is not a free society. Union organizers, they get shot in China. People who are human rights activists, they get thrown in prison, and where are they? And you don't hear, or you find out they're dead. This is not a country you want to live in. And I want China to move toward being what hopefully it will be someday, which is a free society. But Trump doesn't care about that. Trump's an authoritarian. If Donald thought tomorrow that the military would back him, and I don't believe at this point they will,
right,
and he could suspend the Constitution, of course he would do that, because after all, no one's more qualified. I mean, Donald is the smartest person in the world and genetically superior and the world's greatest expert on 20 subjects.
Mick Mulvaney.
Yeah.
Budget Director and Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, payday loans.
So Donald said he was going to drain the swamp, and he brings in people like Mick Mulvaney who represent what's wrong in the swamp. The Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which was Elizabeth Warren's idea, and I've known Elizabeth almost 30 years, and I think she's the finest public servant I have ever met. That agency, hobbled as it is, has brought in about four times as much of its budget and gotten huge recovery for people and gotten
12 billion.
12
right?
billion versus spending like about three. And has helped lots and lots of people. And Mulvaney comes in and immediately wants to cut their budget, stop their doing their work.
Well, cut their budget. He asked for $0.
Zero. No, I mean, cut it to zero.
Yeah.
That's right. And basically what you're seeing here is that instead of draining the swamp, Trump put in the swamp monsters who are going to devour your wallet if you don't stop. And what matters about this is posting things on the internet, you know, at various websites, meaningless. Demonstrations in the streets, like the huge one we saw, the biggest in American history on the day after inauguration and the recent one by women, they're great. But all that matters at the end of the day is who's registered to vote and who turns out to vote and who they vote for. And the most important event, I believe, in domestic American history since the Civil War will occur in November. We will either get a Congress that is, in fact, representative of the American people and run by people who have some integrity, because we're certainly not seeing that from the Republican leadership right now, or in the future, someone who's Donald Trump without his deficit, somebody who isn't nuts, who is educated,
right,
who is competent as a manager, who thinks strategically, will be in the White House, and you can kiss your liberties goodbye. This really matters. We have to address that we made a mistake. And we need to fix that mistake. And we need to recognize somewhere between 25 and 33% of Americans will never accept that it's a mistake.
Right.
Absolutely never going to accept it. On the day Nixon resigned, 29% of Americans were with him, wanted him to stay as president.
So that percentage will vote.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Because people are going to vote. That's why
right.
in the key states in the Midwest and Hillary Clinton's god-awful campaign, which in the book Hacks, Donna Brazile's book written by my friend Danielle Morton for her, very clearly lays out that Hillary Clinton wouldn't listen to advice. She suffered from what the Greeks call hubris.
Oh, my God, yes.
And her arrogance is the reason she's not president.
That's right.
She'd listen to the advice, including people like me, who said, you got to respond to the people who have legitimate grievances and stop talking in blah, 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 blah. Even though when I read the blah, 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 I know how to read that and go, this is great. It's smart policy. To most people, it's just blah, 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 blah. You got to reach to them the way Donald did. She wouldn't listen to anybody, Terrence, and she's not. And I don't think she would have been a great president, but she's not president because of her own hubris.
Oh yeah, and I mean, I have long contended that once the people in charge of the Democratic Party saw that there were two candidates pulling in 25,000 people, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, this was not a normal year,
right?
And no one but an outsider was going to have the passion to get people to the polls.
Well, or alternatively, they had to sit down and have a powwow and say, hey, you know what? The idea of the Maginot Wall doesn't work here. You got to change gears. You need to respond to his campaign. And, you know, if your opponent is running a totally different kind of campaign, you need to change your campaign and respond.
See, but I'm saying I don't think she – I'm
well,
not
she
sure
she could have.
She
won the popular vote. She won the popular vote. And had she – more carefully attuned herself a certain. I mean, she came with a lot of baggage. There's no question about that. Yeah, but I think she could have. Won both.
Okay. We've only got a few minutes. Taxes is your big issue. You've written the book that will come out
next year, hopefully. It's a whole new tax system.
What don't people know, if I give you 2 minutes, what don't people know about the tax bill they should?
You heard on the news, Apple's paying $38 million in taxes. Well, at DC Report, we tell you that ain't true. All you have to do is read the bill. What Congress did was give them an extension of their interest-free loans on the taxes they didn't pay, and it'll be 2025 before Apple pays.
Right, and as you point out, wouldn't it be great if you could get that
kind of deal? Wouldn't you like that?
They're bringing back that money, so they have this big tax bill, only they have 8 years to do it,
right,
and it is zero interest. So they've brought all the money back, billions of dollars.
Right.
Actually,
they don't even have to bring it back. They're free to move it back and forth. But they got this interest-free loan for 92% of the amount, and it's back-loaded. The last 8 years, they pay 25%. So we did an analysis. What happens if you invest this money in the meantime? And we used really low-ball numbers. I mean, really low-ball numbers. Secondly, Donald, who says he's always the champion of the cops and firefighters and the EMTs, well, they no longer get to deduct the cost of buying their uniforms, buying their guns, of their any training they have to pay for that's extra or anything else they pay for. That was taken away from them. Donald proposed in the budget, it's not going to happen, but he said, I'm the champion of the veterans. We're going to take care of the veterans. Well, he proposed for many veterans who are disabled, cutting their $35,000 a year, which is not exactly going to make you rich, to $13,000 a year once they're in their 60s. This is totally contrary to what he said. And they also have proposed, and they may succeed in this, to round down all checks to veterans. Now, the amount of money in the whole year is minimal. It's like $12 million in the whole country. But the symbolism that we're going to nickel and dime veterans is perfect case for this kind of stuff. And the book is just full of these things, Terrence, that you either have never heard or there was glancing mention in the news with no context, so it didn't mean anything. Because I want people to understand, our government... what's being done to our government? What's being done to your job, to your safety, to your children's or grandchildren's or great-grandchildren's safety? What's being done to all sorts of things that aren't being covered because everybody's focused, as they were during the campaign, on the tweets and the nuttiness and the palace intrigue?
Yeah. I mean, you got to take people that don't cover issues anyway and then give them a president this entertaining, if you will.
Yes.
It's just
and he's great entertainment.
That's right. It's even worse than you think, what the Trump administration is doing to America. That's the book. The websites are DC Report, singular, dcreport.org. Daily updates that, like this book, go into what's actually happening behind the news and the tweets and tells you actions you can take. And davidkjohnston.com, David, and then caijohnston.com.
And if you follow me on Twitter, David C-A-Y-J, I usually tell you when we have something notable.
Okay, David C-A-Y-J.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, David K. Johnson.
Terrence, thank you.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. Terrence McNally, TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 6 or 7 relevant articles, email me at TEMcNally@Mac.com, TEMcNally@Mac.com, or sign up at my site. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. Thanks to G, my engineer, and Mark Maxwell in production, and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, each Monday and Wednesday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday,
you can hear us 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear. Scott and Paul. Scott is president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. We're never going to see mills like we saw in the valleys of Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia 5 decades ago. But President Trump does have a chance to stabilize, or at least help to stabilize, the steel industry, which is reeling.
Donald Trump talks in hyperbole, and to him, that's the truth. That's how he talks. So when he says this, it invokes this idea that you're going to bring back massive steel mills or a big old auto plant like you saw Henry Ford put in the 1920s in Detroit. And that, you're right, that's just not going to happen.
Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Wednesday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.